Robert, Linda Robertson Family LLC versus Allen and another, Stephen Delgado, Appellate Counsel, Andrew P. Hill, Matthew F. Aker, Appellate Counsel.
Wait just one moment. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Stephen LaFaso. I represent the Robert and Bertha Robinson Family LLC. For brevity's sake, I'll probably call it the Robinson LLC or Robinson or plaintiff or appellant. Because obviously it's a mouthful. If it pleases the court, really today what we're asking the court to do is to look at the procedure for noting an appeal and perfecting an appeal, and then also what are appropriate grounds for sanctions against a party that is litigating a case. While a lot has been written in the briefs about a counterclaim and whether a counterclaim comes up with the appeal of an original claim from a general district court case, my client, the Robinson LLC, really believes this case can be decided on something far short of that, and that is just a proper interpretation of 16.1106.1. We think for the purposes of understanding how that statute needs to be applied, and the Robinsons believe the court applied that statute wrongly, and it was their first area of error, that we have to kind of look at the procedure, because the statute itself makes differentiates how the court should go about handling a withdrawal of an appeal based upon when the request is made, so forth. In this case, we had a general district court case in the Warren County General District Court. The judge found for the defendants in both the original claim and the counterclaim such that neither plaintiff won. The Robinsons LLC decided to appeal the case on the very last day that was available on the 10th day. Filed this notice of appeal. It then perfected the appeal. Throughout the course of the litigation in the circuit court, the health of the managing members took a downward turn, as such evidence was not available to be responsive to certain pleadings and discovery requests made by the defendants. As such, realizing that although this evidence existed, the likelihood of getting it in because it was not answering discovery would be near next to zero, the Robinson LLC decided that the best course of action for all parties so that they don't go forward on a claim that could not be proven would be to withdraw the appeal and put the parties back in the position that they were at the end of the general district court. In other words, sparing the Allens the need to come into court to prove or disprove the case. It was obvious to us that without the evidence that is put in the joint appendix that the case could not go forward. As such, in good faith, they said, let's withdraw it. The request for withdrawal was made, and then an opposition was filed, and the court set a hearing for this. Now, if you look at 16.1106.1, basically, Section A2 says that after an appeal has been perfected, an appealing party may request that the appeal be withdrawn in circuit court. And then Section B says that then, obviously, opposing party has the right to come forward and object to it. And then Section C basically says what should happen when the party objects. Now, what happened in this case is the circuit court allowed the withdrawal. They entered an order saying the case was withdrawn. But they went further than just withdrawing the case. They found for the Allens on their counterclaim, although no trial had taken place, and they sanctioned the Robinson LLC in the amount of $10,000, claiming that the whole appeal and the entire case in general was just not brought in good faith. Obviously, the Robinsons disagree. We believe that the first error made, just going to the statute, is the what I'll call the $2,600 judgment for the breach of contract for the Allens. I think if you look at the statutory language very clearly, it's very clear that 106.1 states what a judge can do upon a withdrawal motion.
Was the counterclaim even before the circuit court to begin with? The General District Court ruled against the tenants, right, on the counterclaim?
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
So there's, if that were the end of the case and there were no appeal by anybody, res judicata would apply and that no one could ever raise it again.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the landlord, your client, appeals. The tenant doesn't appeal the denial of its claim. So why is it even there? Why are we talking about withdrawal if it's not there to begin with?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I agree with, doesn't matter what I think. My client agrees with you. But my client specifically believes that the statutory language does not state that a counterclaim comes up upon the notice of appeal and perfection of appeal of a claim.
So with the general rule of circuit court to an appellate court, both sides have to appeal whatever they need to appeal to change the result.
Right, and I think what the Allen's argument will be is that the way the statutory, I guess, construction or wording or looking at the overall statutory scheme, that one can divine the legislative intent, that it was the legislative's intent that a counterclaimant would not need to file an appeal or note an appeal or pay a bond or do any of the things which the statute says are mandatory, 107, I believe, says are mandatory to give the circuit court jurisdiction to hear the appeal.
It appears to be that whatever comes up is de novo, therefore everything comes up. My question is, isn't that a non sequitur?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
The argument's being made is that it's a de novo review.
Correct.
Actually, we have a de novo review, too, over lower courts on questions of law and things like that.
Correct.
But then that argument is being used to define the scope of what actually is before us.
Right. I understand. And I think there's a differentiation between de novo and jurisdiction. Okay, and I think we have to drive a dividing line. De novo does not mean you have jurisdiction over everything. De novo means that you look at the facts and the law anew from what you have jurisdiction over. And I think what my client's argument would be is that the circuit court never had jurisdiction over the counterclaim because the jurisdictional prerequisites, which are in the statute, of noticing an appeal within 10 days, of posting a bond, of doing a writ tax.
What do you make of the fact that there's not an insignificant amount of circuit judges who treat the whole thing very generally as a dispute that goes from the lower court to the circuit court and all the claims, counterclaims, cross-claims, whatever?
I mean, that makes no... I mean, to my client, I mean, that makes no difference. I mean, people always think, lots of people think, things are one way. And then it turns out that some of us who have maybe a better understanding or a different look at it are actually the ones that are correct. And I'm hoping that you on this panel are going to look at it the way that we look at it and look
Why
at it differently.
Why wouldn't this sequencing of statutes and case law support their position? 16.188.01 indicates that when there is a claim and a counterclaim, the court shall render such final judgment on the whole case, both the counterclaim and the claim. Then, as they argue, we then look at 16.1106, says from any order of the lower court, any order of the general district court, which 88.01 would seem to indicate it is the whole case, the counterclaim and the original claim. And then if we look at our decision in Gomel, where the effect of an appeal is to transfer the entire record to the appellate court for retrial as though originally brought there. Why don't those sequencing of statutes and case law support their position that if you appeal, the entire case goes up? And it's
Yeah, well, I think you answered your own question, ma'am, by stating, you said, when I look at the statute, you assume or it seems to state.
Well, we're interpreting statutes as to
state,
what they
right.
seem to
Exactly,
think.
And our argument is that, look, this is an abrogation of the common law. You don't have an automatic right to appeal, okay? This is a creature of statute. And as such, the statutory language has to be specifically there to allow it. And if the legislature, for some reason, failed to put it in there and created this giant void that won't work without your interpretation or without the court changing the laws around some ways, I mean, that's just not the...
The order of the court is on the entire case. And 106 says, from an order entered, why wouldn't the entire case go up?
Well, I think that the reason the entire case doesn't go up is that we don't know exactly, one, what the order is going to say. We may have situations
where... We know what the order said because it's been entered.
Right, in this case, I understand. So no hypotheticals. I perfectly understand, ma'am. No, I think the reason it does not come up is because, look, all the statute is saying is that if you have a claim and a counterclaim, right, you can treat them as one case, you can treat them separately. The statute allows them to do either. They have to make a judgment on both claims. But nowhere does that say that because the claim is done as a whole and only one party appeals, that then the counterclaims parties comes up as well.
In the circuit court, we don't have any jurisdiction absent the interlocutory appeal or partial appeal certification to hear anything that doesn't have a resolution attached to it that's a final order adjudicating all claims. But obviously that doesn't mean that someone who loses a cross-claim or a counterclaim or a third-party claim doesn't have to appeal that when one of the other parties does.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. I think what the issue here is that, you know, there also has to be, you have to take into consideration the issues of notice and opportunity as well in some ways. I mean, I think if you look at it this way, I mean, look, basically, up until the first hearing in circuit court, I think the Robinson Family LLC had no clue that the counterclaim was even before the circuit court because no appeal was filed, no bond was posted, and so they thought that, oh, let's appeal it on the last day.
Here's what I'm saying, though. You cannot appeal to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court unless you have a final judgment adjudicating all claims with certain statutory exceptions, right?
Correct.
So that's the same thing that the system works between general district court and circuit court. But that doesn't mean that losers on some claims don't have to appeal if losers on other claims do appeal.
All right, correct. And you may be in a situation where you have a defendant who doesn't want to appeal their claim, let's say, and the plaintiff does, and they're going to have to retry their claim, even though both parties maybe were okay with what came out, because they're just disagreeing about the original claim. They're not no longer disagreeing about the counterclaim. They agree with the court on the counterclaim, but now that's going to come up as well, even though neither party really wants to have that matter come up. I mean, that's what's going to happen here. And so I just, from a practical perspective, the statute does not state specifically that the counterclaim comes up. And I think that the Robinson would argue that, look, the defendants or the people who want an appeal have to take some affirmative action to keep their claim alive. Otherwise, you're in one of the cases where we had, which I cited, where you had, there was no judgment in the counterclaim, and they didn't do anything about it. Well, it's the same thing. Look, if you are not going to be diligent in prosecuting your claims, if you really want an appeal of that counterclaim, then why didn't you file the notice in the 10 days? And if you didn't, then you're waiving, right? Or if we're allowing it, then we're allowing extra time. And then the time period really isn't 10 days. It's 10 days or if the other party appeals, right? I mean, so I just think that starts getting to, it just makes it very difficult for parties to know what's going on. And the purpose of the law is to give us some type of sanity and knowledge. So we say, look,
right, but
what
if we decide it consistent with these many circuit court opinions, that would provide notice to everybody and it would settle the issue.
Right, I would totally agree with that, but I think that's the issue, is that it hasn't been provided. But I think that outside of that, before I reserve the rest of my time, we just think that really, whether it should go up or not, let's say if it did go up, once the withdrawal was granted, then if it goes up as a whole, it's got to come down as a whole as well. You can't start splitting claims up there unless you would do things like non-suit and things to that effect where you're dealing with individual claims. But if you're withdrawing an appeal that my client has appealed, then their claims should certainly go as well. And so the whole 25,
if their claims are theoretically construed to be attached to your claims, but if they were to separately appeal, then it would survive, right?
Right.
Just as it would between the circuit court and the Supreme Court.
Correct.
If they're separate, why would the counterclaimant have to agree to the withdrawal of the original, of the plaintiff's claim?
Well, there may be reasons why the defendant doesn't want the counterclaim to be withdrawn. Say, in this case, I think the Allens wanted a motion for sanctions to be heard.
But the statute provides you cannot withdraw your appeal unless the counterclaimant agrees. And according to the statute, if they do, the entire case goes away, not just your appeal.
Well, I don't think it says the counter. I don't think the statute says to counterclaim it. I think it says that the party that did not appeal has the right to object. So they could be a, they don't even have to be a counterclaimant to object. Anybody can object. I could just, it could just be one claim in general district court.
Correct.
And I bring it up. And then the other side says, I want to withdraw it. The other side says, oh, no, we're not going to allow me to withdraw it. But we have this reason, we want the court to hear. You know, and so that's kind of where we are. And with 15 seconds left on, just, and I thank the court for your time and ask that you find to have my client and just dismiss this case, basically, and we put back in the judgment of the general district court as required by statute. Thank you.
You have just used all of the... Sorry, there is no rebuttal. You just used it all.
I just used it all. Yes, I understand that, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the court. My name is Andrew Hill, and I represent the appellees in this matter, Douglas and Deborah Allen, who were longtime commercial tenants at a property in Front Royal, Warren County, Virginia, of the appellant, the Robert and Bertha family, Robinson LLC. This court has already heard and engaged in a substantial discussion of the issue of the counterclaim and whether or not a general district court counterclaim that it is filed and on which a judgment is pursued in the lower court is then rides piggyback, in the words of a circuit court case, which I'll get to in a minute, to the circuit court for rehearing.
But what is the authority for that? I mean, I read the opinions too, and I accept that in some jurisdictions that's conventional wisdom, but that's not the way appeals work.
Well, I believe that it is. I believe it's consistent. Obviously, there is limited guidance from this court on the issue, and appellant's counsel and I will agree on that. But I do think it's consistent with this court's ruling in the KB Corp case from 1977, where this court held that when a counterclaim at the general district court level was not pursued to a final judgment, then that the ability for that litigant to pursue the counterclaim on appeal went away. I think the implication there is that if a final judgment had been pursued, that it would have been part of the whole case, as required by 16.1-88.01, that judgment to be rendered together.
Help me with the logic of this, because I don't see that point that you just made as any different than the normal point, which is we don't hear cases from the circuit courts on appeal unless it goes to final judgment. Final judgment is a judgment that resolves all the disputes, counterclaims, cross-claims, third-party claims, all kind of claims. But the only people that get to the appellate court on their claim is those that appeal and want to change, those that appeal when they're asking to change the result. If you lose a counterclaim in circuit court and the other side appeals and you don't appeal that loss of the counterclaim to us or to the Court of Appeals, absent some statutory exception, it's over. So that is the default, I think, pretty much everywhere. So why is it different here? And it seems to me the burden of persuasion is on you to establish that there's authority for doing it differently than the norm. And the de novo argument doesn't help me because de novo is not scope. It's just standard of review.
Right. And I think on that final point in particular, I think that the de novo language is used somewhat interchangeably, especially when you're looking back to these older cases like the Thomas Jamel case, citing that case from Missouri saying that on de novo appeal, it basically hit the pause button. All parties are kept in the same position they were in the lower court, and the entire scope of the litigation, both counter cross claims and the primary claim, is brought up to the higher court for review.
Did any case say that? I mean, I've spent probably as much time as you have trying to find the case that says what you just said, and I haven't found it.
I believe the Thomas Jamel case does say that.
The counterclaim comes up on appeal by the primary claimant's notice of appeal.
Well, okay, maybe not directly, but I think the framework is there for, again, hitting the pause button, taking everything that's before the lower court, putting it in the higher court, so that all parties remain in the same position as they had been in before that first judgment was entered.
One consequence of your position, if I follow it, is that suppose the shoe's on the other foot and the counterclaimant. Let's say the Robinsons lose on the merits, and they say, oh, well, we tried, we lost. But your client's upset about the denied counterclaim, and they appeal. saying, hey, we want our security deposit back, that would then, the entire thing would be heard de novo, and then Robinson's in that scenario could come and say, well, in addition to this business about the security deposit, we owed all this back rent in addition. So it would work both ways.
Exactly, right.
Okay.
And we're not trying to make the argument that it's special to a counterclaim. I think, in the situation Your Honor just presented, I think that would be...
What if the other side doesn't want their case reheard? They're satisfied with what the general district court...
Right, and my counterpart raised that issue. I don't think that they're required to pursue it. I think they can elect not to if they're content with the judgment of the general district court. They don't want to go through the expenditure and the time of pursuing their case again. Then I don't think they're forced to.
So they just abandon it in circuit court?
I believe so.
Just don't show up?
Well, I don't know that they don't show up, but that they at least, or even advise the trial court that they're not, that they're not pursuing, that they're not re-pursuing that part of their claim.
May I interrupt one more time?
Yes.
How do you deal with the common law point? It showed up several times in our case law. There is no common law right of appeal.
Right.
Therefore, statutes are construed pretty narrowly to not abrogate that principle. And here, the only way to get to the counterclaimant having a piggyback appeal is to build a couple of statutory inferences upon themselves. Is that enough?
I believe it is. I believe, and again, when my counterpart was up here, I think the language of 16.1-88.01 about a judgment being rendered on the whole case was explored. And that statute deals, it gives
isn't that true in circuit court? The judgment has to be rendered upon the whole case before we hear an appeal. I'm not seeing the logical significance of that, to me, obvious point.
Right. And I think, perhaps the difference may be between the appeal process from a circuit court to this court versus the general district court to the circuit court. I think there is a clear statute, 16.1-106, on appeals from the GDC to the circuit court that addresses the issue of from any order or judgment entered, there is an appeal of right if taken within 10 days, and the hearing shall be heard de novo. So I think, again, in practice and as borne out by the plentiful circuit court cases that I cited, I believe that takes the entire case and brings it up. And it's so perhaps there is a difference of framework between the GDC to circuit court appeal versus the circuit court or the circuit court to the court of appeals or to this court. I think reading the statutes together with a judgment needing to be rendered on the whole case if a counterclaim is filed in 88.01, and then as was discussed earlier, the final order being appealed from in 16.1-106. I think that is sufficient cause to request that this court affirm the judgment
What if the counterclaim had a judgment amount attached to it, and if they were going to appeal, then they would have to post a bond? If the counterclaim had to appeal, had a judgment, they would have to post a bond, correct?
Right.
But in your scenario, they appeal. You don't have to post a bond. What protects them on appeal if there is no bond on the counterclaim?
Well, in this case in particular, a bond was not required from either side because no...
In a case where a bond would be required.
Right. If somebody wanted to appeal a monetary judgment, then obviously they would have to post the bond.
If the counterclaimant had the monetary judgment, they appeal. You don't post a bond. What protects them on appeal? Because you didn't appeal.
Right. In that scenario, I think, if us as the holders of the counterclaim, if we had the judgment, then they would be the onus would be on the claimant, the original claimant, to post the bond since the money judgment is rendered against them.
We spent a lot of time on the jurisdictional point because it has the greatest precedential significance.
Right.
But can you help me with? Ordinarily, to sanction somebody, you need facts before you to determine they acted in bad faith, and then to render judgment against them, unless you're in a default judgment situation, you need them to present their case. It seems like the court just kind of short-circuited all that. So help me understand why we the circuit court was correct in the sanctions and on the counterpoint.
Sure. On the issue of sanctions, obviously that's the largest of the issues. I would posit that for the court, at least in terms of the monetary consequence, there was no. Obviously, in a lot of sanctions cases that this court has decided, it's they're really mixed questions of fact and law. There's, you know, questions about whether or not the facts are there, questions about whether or not the law supports what the sanctioned party was attempting to do. Here, I made the point on brief that we're not looking at that. Obviously, as a clear breach of lease, breach of contract case, we have no position to take that Robinson did not have the ability to bring the action that it did. There's been no argument any time in any of the record that's before the court did my clients make the argument that the Robinsons did not have the ability to bring a simple breach of lease case. Instead, what we're looking at is the core facts that were there, the core, and specifically that the trial court focused on a few issues. In the record, you have all the pleadings that led up to that hearing on June 8th of 2016 at which the sanctions motion was considered. And those pleadings and echoed it in argument before the trial court really lay out not only the broad history of the interactions between these parties, but also the history of this litigation in particular. Specifically, kind of the first step we take down that road is their failure to respond to discovery timely, even after good faith efforts were made to secure the.
And I hear you. His response was, but they're elderly and frail, and then their condition deteriorated, which led them to not be able to properly respond. And so, is that different than someone who's just obstreperous? I mean, what I'm getting at is, would you have needed fact finding on that point? Because your argument is, hey, you know, they're just dragging this thing out and they have no good faith basis, they're not even responding to discovery, and he's articulating a basis for why they couldn't. And so, well, we don't, you know, they weren't brought in or some form of evidence to flesh out who's right and who's wrong.
Right. And I think in at least a vague sense, the trial court did consider that. I believe that the court took that into consideration. Obviously, you know, I specifically did not take a position on Mr. Robinson's health issue because that's not my place. But what I did point out to the court is what, you know, the good faith portion of this, the evidentiary portion of this, of, you know, admittedly putting the evidence before the court in its motion to reconsider that happened 3 weeks after the scheduled trial date. And so finally, 3 weeks after the trial, 10 months after the initial filing in general district court, finally we have this volume of evidence that the trial court was never asked to receive, but that purportedly shows that there was a good faith basis for the claim. And I think considering the timeline here...
What was the bad faith again? Was it discovery sanction? Because 8.01.271.1 is not a discovery sanction.
Right, exactly. It started in the realm of discovery for their failure to respond, but then it moved once...
Well, assume that's not relevant, because discovery rules and discovery statutes deal with that, not the sanction statute.
Right, so it kind of morphed from discovery into the bad faith argument when the appeal was thought to be withdrawn, when
so
there was no...
What is the bad faith argument? They filed on a lease. The lease said what it said. It seemed to be sort of draconian, but it said what it said, and it was agreed to. And there was no argument that the lease was invalid, per se. What's the bad faith?
Well, the bad faith was...
an argument, but where's the bad faith?
The bad faith was continuing to press the issue, continuing to drive up the cost, to increase my client's expenditures, and they knew that it was a loser.
Continuing to press what issue?
The issues of seeking to have the property put back in the condition it was in before the lease began. The issue
but the
of
lease
this
expressly said that. It said. Right. Now, I understand. If I understand, your client's position was, yeah, it said that, but there was a course of conduct, there were some verbal discussions that trumped the lease, and that's fine, but all of that, and you may be absolutely right that it wasn't bad faith, but the difficulty I'm having is simply on this record, without factual finding, figuring out who's right and who's wrong.
Right. So I think it was a combination of the chronology here that I just outlined a little bit, but then also the failure to have that core of evidence there. Again, really all that was produced in discovery was the same few documents that had been produced at the general district court level. There was an admission in the answers to interrogatories that that Robinson had no independent recollection of the basis for the amounts on which they were suing my clients. And, you know, right there, I think, is a clear clear evidence that there was a violation of the good faith basis to have that, you know, not all evidence, as my counterpart argues, but I think there has to be a core of evidence there at the beginning of an appeal, in this case, to provide the good faith basis for that claim. And so I think looking at the chronology, looking at that failure to have that good faith basis for pursuing the appeal, the good faith evidentiary basis, in my opinion, that really was the basis for the trial court's reasoning in that matter. And really all my clients were doing was seeking.
If you have somebody who's 90 whose health is deteriorating and they say, you know, I just don't remember, is that a different scenario than someone who's just... I don't mean to be circular with you, but that's the difficulty I'm having, is that it's not necessarily, you know, bad health and dementia or whatever may be the case is not the same thing as bad faith.
Well, and that may be the case, but I, you know, again, in looking at the chronology of it, the issues with the health really didn't crop up until the last about 3 weeks of the case. And so when we look back for the entirety of the history of the litigation, it's really only at the 11th hour that argument comes in. And
I don't know.
I see that I'm out of time, so thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Call the next case.